Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The true function of the jury is fact-finding, and this includes a determination of the amount of actual damages. This was the jury's true function in 1820 when the people in the original Bill of Rights constitutionalized the common law incidence of jury trial. This must remain the jury's true function today if the right as heretofore enjoyed is to remain inviolate. Section 538.210 violates this constitutional guarantee. That law retains the common law cause of action for medical negligence, but overrules the jury's factual determination of the amount of damages for non-economic harm, and it does so in a manner unrecognized in 1820. The legislature does not have the authority to set itself up as a trier of fact or to nullify the jury's fact-finding. The people reserve to themselves the authority to determine the amount of damages and to do so without interference. Now, this court in Adams reached a contrary conclusion. In Adams, the court determined that the legislature can determine the amount of damages, that this was a question of law, not fact, and it was not a question for the jury. But this was Adams's fundamental error. Compare Adams's conclusion to what this court said in Woodson versus Scott in 1855. It said, the juries of the country are the most appropriate judges of the amount of injury sustained, and to them is properly assigned the authority and right to assess the consequent amount of damages therefore. So you see two statements there. One is about authority, who is authorized to determine the amount of damages. And Woodson says it's consistent with the plain meaning of the Constitution, it's the jury. And what does that
opposing counsel and Adams say that they don't disagree with that, but once the jury determines the facts, then they're done and they don't get it. And there's no right to have the judgment be entered for the amount that the jury's determined. Can you address that more specifically?
Yes, Your Honor. That ignores the constitutional magnitude of the jury's fact-finding. And let me emphasize what Woodson said, the second part of Woodson. It said it's the right to assess the consequent amount of damages. It's a determination with consequence. It's not a determination that's advisory, that the legislature can then substitute its view of the amount of damages, including by saying that damages for compensatory damage will be $1. That is not, that pays lip service to the jury, but robs the institution of its function. And that was Adams's fundamental error. And you see that in Woodson versus Scott. You see it also in, yes, Your
opposing
Honor.
Counsel and some of the amicus briefs suggest that, well, that kind of legislation would be, would not be enforced because it would be arbitrary and capricious and not a reasonable substitute, but that what they have enacted is a reasonable limitation on damages.
Well, but that's a separate due process question.
I understand, but they say it still wouldn't violate, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm asking right. Under this, they say, well, that doesn't change the argument here. It's still their right to change it to $1 if they want to, although you might be able to strike it down on other grounds because it's unreasonable and arbitrary.
Now, our position on jury trial is that whether it's $1 or $1 million, any cap, any limitation on the jury's fact-finding is an invasion of the right to trial by jury, because at common law in 1820, it was the jury's role to determine damages, and it was the ultimate arbiter of damages. So whether the invasion is small or whether it's great is not material to jury trial analysis. And at most, this court has allowed the judiciary to exercise very limited review of jury verdicts. But even that tradition, and I'm referring here to the doctrine of remitter and new trial, even that tradition demonstrates that it was the jury that was the ultimate arbiter of damages. If you look at remitter as practiced at common law, the judge could not require a remitter. The judge could suggest a remitter, and it had to be conditioned on the plaintiff's right to have a jury, another jury, then determine the damages. And if there was a second trial, the jury returned a verdict, then the judge could not rule that the award was excessive. So that is another indication that it was the jury's role to be the ultimate arbiter.
Now, let me ask you about the structure of workers' comp. And in 1821, I assume we could have had jury trials for a workers' industry and injury, yet they did the workers' comp structure without any constitutional amendment to change the to write to a jury. It was all basically initiative petition, which is a statute or some other something other than changing the Constitution. How do you rationalize the lack of a jury trial in workers' comp?
Yes, Your Honor. What this court said in DeMay is that the jury trial right is not implicated because there the cause of action was abrogated. And when there is no civil trial, there is no right to trial by jury. And you see this analysis in the Sophie case is quite helpful in describing workers' comp and how if there is no civil trial, then there can be no civil trial right to jury.
And could they just say no medical malpractice, there shall be no jury?
If they abrogated the common law cause of action, then you would consider under other constitutional provisions whether that's constitutional, whether there's a substitute remedy. But if the common law cause of action is abrogated, then the civil trial right is not implicated if there is no civil trial to be had.
Trial by jury implicates there is a trial, and whether you can get rid of a trial, a cause of action entirely is addressed under different constitutional provisions, not under the right to trial by jury.
That's correct, Your Honor, because it's a historical test. So it looks at the common law incidence of jury trial in 1820. And in 1820, there was no jury trial for administrative proceedings, which is essentially what workers' compensation is.
This court has under advisement another case that argues the cap on economic damages, non-economic damages, is improper and constitutional. And some of the same arguments are made in that case are the same as you're making today, too. That case was a wrongful death case as opposed to medical mal. Is there a distinction between the types of cases and these arguments?
Well, the first question in the analysis is whether the right to trial by jury attaches. And so here in this case, we're dealing with a common law cause of action that no one disputes that the right attaches here. There may be a separate question in that case about whether the right attaches to wrongful death.
And I believe was there a right to have a jury determine, did there a wrongful death action exist at all in 1820? And was it tried to a jury?
Well, what this court has said and what Judge Wolf said in Klotz was no, that wrongful death was not recognized at common law. But that is not an issue in this case, so it's not a history that I've studied. So I would refer you to
if, the if that's the case, it would be a factual distinction, but you can't speak to whether it's the case.
Well, I can tell you that this court's precedents has said that wrongful death was not recognized at common law. That this is an example, wrongful death, suits against the sovereign. These are examples of cases in which the legislature created a statute that was not analogous to any kind of cause of action.
But yes, if people died in an accident, or people died in medical malpractice, you could still sue. It's just they created something called wrongful death, as opposed to what was there before.
Well, and that's the question that the court may reexamine. It may look more closely at that history and conclude that.
But it's not this case.
Right.
So you're saying, in effect, by preserving the form of it, it's like you said, jury find the facts and throw them in the waste can, or the jury should just find if you're over or below, if your damages are above or below the economic cap set by the legislature.
Well, if I understand the question, that's what this cap is doing. It's nullifying the jury's verdict, and it's nullifying. It's not giving you the benefit of a jury trial as that was understood at common law in 1820. The benefit of the jury trial is to have 12 citizens of this state determine the amount of damages, not the legislature. The legislature does not have the authority to determine facts on a case-by-case basis. And if you look at Adams, Adams is an outlier because Adams concluded that statutory law can trump the constitutional rights. But this court has said repeatedly in Lee versus Conrad, and more recently in Deal, in Scott, in the state of Overbay, that the right where it applies is beyond the reach of hostile legislation. So in this sense, Adams is really an outlier and is not in conformity with this court's long-standing precedents.
The cases around the country seem to have split fairly evenly on this issue. And as you note, the majority of those whose constitutions say the right shall be preserved inviolate agree that you cannot have a statutory cap on damages, but not all of them. And others that also recognize the right to jury trial strongly, though without using that language, have split both ways. How do you explain this split, and why half the courts have disagreed with your argument. I know you why you know what I know you think you know why half agree with your argument, but can you tell me about the other half?
Well, I think the other half reached kind of the same reasoning as Adams, which was that the jury makes a determination and then the legislature can invade that determination and determine for itself what the amount of damages are. And the better reason cases, the ones that have ruled that these laws are unconstitutional, as the Georgia Supreme Court recently did unanimously, said that that reasoning is not persuasive because it pays lip service to the jury, but it robs the institution of its function, and it ignores the constitutional magnitude of the jury's fact-finding. That is what the jury's fact-finding meant in 1820. You don't see any sort of legislative limitation on damages in this way until 166 years after the common law incidents to trial by jury were constitutionalized. This court in Woodson versus Scott, again, reflected quite correctly that it's the right to assess the consequent amount of damages, not the right to provide an advisory opinion as to the amount of damages.
And you mentioned Georgia. How many other states have stricken the cap on non-economic damages?
I think by my count, it's six. We list them in the in our brief, Your Honor. I believe
originally Illinois. I mean, at the same time as we were deciding the Plunts case,
yes.
Illinois, Wisconsin, a couple years before, but Illinois very and Georgia almost the same week as we were deciding the hearing Plunts.
Illinois was on separation of powers, basically.
Illinois was on separation of powers, which is kind of a very close analysis to the analysis of trial by jury. But you do have Georgia, which most recently was a unanimous decision. And you have long-standing cases, such as you have the Sophie case from Washington and the Lakin case from Oregon. And before my time is up, let me say that Cox Medical Center has come up with a parade of horribles that it says would occur if this court were to enforce the constitutional right consistent with its plain meaning. But look at the experience of those other states. None of these parade of horribles has materialized. In none of those states has the legislature been barred from abrogating the common law or creating causes of action. In none of those states has workers' compensation been declared unconstitutional or state sovereign immunity statutes or summary judgments. This parade of horribles simply has no basis in reality, and the only horrible we could imagine is if the court were to adhere to its prior decision, which changed the language the people adopted.
Before you sit down,
yes.
You talked about adhering to final decision. One key argument your opposing counsel makes is that even if you're right, even if Adams was incorrect, stare decisis applies and we should not overrule it. We've reached a decision on which side we're going to come down on.
Yes, Your Honor. Stare decisis is not an inexorable command, and this court has said that it will not change the plain meaning of the Constitution. It will not rewrite the words that the people chose. The people here chose language that constitutionalizes the common law incidence of jury trial. We know what that means. The jury determines the damages. And it said that this is inviolate. It provided this with the highest order of protection. So Adams was clearly and manifestly wrong. And you do not advance stare decisis, which is to show respect for the law, by adhering to a decision that is directly contrary to the language and plain meaning of the Constitution. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. The General Assembly would be surprised to learn that according to the plaintiff, they cannot change the common law, though they've been doing it for nearly two centuries now. With respect to the first issue I want to address, and that is stare decisis, we'll begin where we left off with the appellants there. And that is, in order for this court to reverse that, it has to be clearly erroneous and manifestly wrong. When admittedly half of the states that have considered this have gone the other direction, I think it is completely out of line with that standard.
That's not true of states that have the same constitutional provision that we have. I think only one is
Idaho,
invalidated it.
Idaho, the Supreme Court of Idaho ruled consistent with this court's decision in Adams.
And so,
Maryland had a very similar statutory, constitutional provision. And so, if there are other Supreme Courts, there are other state courts throughout the country who have reached the same rationale that this court did in Adams, I don't think you can get to a situation in which you have clearly erroneous and manifestly wrong decision by this court, which this
and certainly courts have gone both ways. Adams didn't recognize the difference in language between the Virginia decision in Etheridge that it relied on and Missouri's use of the word inviolate. And Virginia does not give that level of protection to a jury trial. So that site didn't really support it. Since that time, courts have gone both ways.
And what I would
what are the policy reasons?
And what I would say on that is that the language of the Virginia court is the constitution there is different than the language in Missouri. But really, every state constitution protects the jury trial right and views it as sacred. I can't remember if it was Virginia or Maryland that used the word that it's sacred. So it is protected similarly. And I want to back to the notion
in,
of
in suits between man and man, trial by jury is preferable to any other and ought to be held sacred.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say inviolate. That mayor, tell me why that's dispositive or not dispositive.
I don't think that's dispositive in this case. I mean the language that the Missouri Constitution says as heretofore enjoy. If you go to that language, I think that language is equally as important as the language inviolate. And in 1820, what was heretofore enjoyed was the legislature's ability and authority to amend, alter, and even abrogate the common law.
And that was an enjoyment, though. That was I mean, the jury trial was heretofore enjoyed. Taking it away is not necessarily enjoyment on the part of the litigants.
Well, that principle inherent into the jury trial right, and the precursor to section 1.010 indicated this. The common law was the law of the land until altered or repealed. Not just repealed, not just abrogated, but also altered.
But as I know you know, opposing counsel has not argued in this case that the legislature, under this provision at least, is unable to alter the common law. But their point is, if citing Deal and what this court said in Deal, is once you recognize this cause of action, you can't take away the right to due process, you can't take away the fundamental constitutional rights. And in Missouri, certainly, we have the right to jury trial is inviolate, is a fundamental constitutional right, not simply a matter of common law, which in many cases in Missouri have suggested the legislature can abrogate.
Well, the right to jury trial is not removed. It's not removed in this case. It's the remedy that is provided in a medical malpractice case is altered, but not the right to a jury trial. And that's the distinction here. And let me just go to the issue of this fact-finding and whether or not that is a fundamental piece of the jury trial right. It is true that juries have that responsibility to be the fact-finders, and that law is well established. But the decision from there, as many courts have found, once that decision is done, once that fact-finding is done, it is then an issue of law. And I'll quote a couple
If we're to accept that, because obviously the jury finds facts, the court applies the law to the facts, but what that means, could, for instance, the legislature enact a statute that would say, jury shall find the amount of damages, that shall be advisory, the court can award whatever damages it wants, as opposed to putting in a cap, because then you would apply that law to those facts.
Yeah. Once the jury,
where's the limit? Where's on the slippery slope, in other words, I know you recognize, and you're saying there's one way. What about the other way?
Consistent with our position in the in our brief, that determination is not an issue of jury trial. Once the jury has determined damages, it can be reduced down.
So what else can the legislature do, and what's left?
If the legislature removed all damages, is that what you're?
What could we just say, juries can find all the facts, but it's completely advisory and the court can substitute its judgment.
I don't know how many different permutations you could.
Can we say the jury finds the facts on which elements have been proved, but the court can then decide that that's not the case, and not Janovi, that there weren't factual questions. Where's the limit if we're to do that? As you know, a question we always ask here, not just how what you're arguing about applies in the case before us, but how it would apply in other cases. And I'm not clear what the limit would be, then doesn't it really become, even if you don't think this is form over substance, I'm concerned certainly at some point it is, and what is that point? How do you distinguish these cases?
And I don't know where the line would be necessarily, but the certainly the legislature has the power and authority to determine the remedy that's available to a plaintiff in a common law case, as in a statutory case. Where that line is, if they could take it down to zero, I think that would implicate other provisions of the Constitution, potentially. But I'll say this.
How would that implicate other provisions if they took it down to zero?
Well, if the legislature has provided a cause of action and provides no remedy for it, you might have an issue with open courts or something of that nature.
So let's get into that, open courts. So at $350,000, if there's, we talk about quote-unquote a parade of horribles, what about the fact that more and more people cannot afford to bring cases because no lawyer will take a case, or less and less fewer lawyers will take a case at $350,000 cap than otherwise, so they don't have an open court?
Yeah. The first answer to that is that open courts was not raised in this case, and so that's not an issue. That issue was not raised in this case. And what I was simply saying is that, there are potential other remedies that are available, but the remedy is not whether or not the jury trial right has been violated. And let me just read.
Is that really what a trial by jury was, though? It concerns me philosophically. Would in 1820 the people who were writing Missouri's Constitution, is that what they meant? That you can just have the jury tell you what they think damages are, tell you what they think liability is, but then their job is done, and you can enter any judgment you want.
The Third Circuit, as well as the Sixth Circuit, or the Fourth Circuit, as well as the Sixth Circuit, said this about the jury trial rule, and this is applying the Seventh Amendment, which would be the same analysis in terms of the fact finding responsibility of the jury. And they said this: the jury's role as fact finder is to determine the extent of plaintiff's injuries, not to determine the legal consequences of its factual findings. That was the principle that would have existed in 1820 when the Seventh Amendment was in place. That's the same principle that would have existed in Missouri's constitutional provisions, and is reflected in the history of the common law and the legislature's ability to alter it or amend it, and even to abrogate it. The other principle that goes along with this is another one that was cited by the Fourth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit with respect to the Seventh Amendment, and that is, if you have the authority to abrogate the entire cause of action or the entire remedy, it naturally follows that a limiting principle or a smaller portion of that could also be.
But then you could get rid of due process, you can get rid of notice, you can get rid of anything, because you could get rid of any cause of action, so we'll just decide this case without serving you with the petition. That principle can't, in and of itself, govern.
That principle governs the jury trial right. It doesn't necessarily govern due process or other things that you.
But they're both constitutional provisions.
Sure, they are.
Rights.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you could remove, under the jury trial right, you could remove the cause of action entirely, which we see in workers' compensation.
Right.
They completely removed it, abrogated it. And now, if they didn't provide a substitutional remedy, they might have had problems in other areas.
Right.
And that's equally true here. And so the same principle, the common law principle.
What's the substitutional remedy for limiting damages? Right.
There's not a substitutional remedy for limiting damages. You then go to an analysis of whether or not the remedy that is provided violates one of the other constitutional provisions, whether or not it violates due process, equal protection, some of those. And as argued in this case, it doesn't violate those either. We're not talking about heightened scrutiny that requires strict scrutiny. We'd be talking about rational basis scrutiny, and in that, the standard is very deferential. Any set of facts that can reasonably be conceived is the standard for that review. And so, under the jury, if we're focusing on the jury trial right, the issue is whether or not the legislature has the authority, the power under the common law or under their authority to limit or even abrogate a cause of action or remedy. And that existed in 1820, and it exists today.
On the equal protection argument.
Yes.
If I am injured and the jury finds my damages to be less than the cap, I recover my complete award of damages. If I'm injured and the jury finds that I get above the cap, I'm restricted. Why is that treating me equally?
Well, it doesn't treat the award equally, but under equal protection, there is no a medical malpractice victim is not a suspect classification.
If it's suspect, gets strict scrutiny. Doesn't have to be. Doesn't have to get strict scrutiny, but you still have an equal protection claim.
And my apologies. Were you asking about heightened scrutiny or rational basis?
Rational basis. Why is that though treating me equally?
Or
are you just saying what the state has the ability to treat us unequally?
If it has a rational basis.
Yeah, as long as it has a rational basis, they do have the ability to treat medical malpractice victims differently in terms of what level of award is returned. Now, the rational basis for that are the ones that are listed in Adams, were considered and submitted in Adams and are equally applicable here today, and that is trying to reduce the overall cost of health care and the availability of health care to everyone.
In the rational basis analysis, is there any comparison relative to the rationale expressed for the limitation as opposed to the extent of the impact? For instance, someone who has been awarded by a jury $5 or $10 million has an inordinate impact relative to someone that was only awarded $500,000.
And let me try to clarify that.
What I'm saying is we have the very most injured people are hurt the worst.
Yeah, feel the
by the cap.
Feel the greater impact
relative to those who are the very least injured people who receive a full recovery.
Yeah.
Is there any way that is weighed against the rational basis for the law?
I'm not aware that element of it, because I slip back into the strict scrutiny sort of standpoint, and that is, it's not treating any particular class differently, and there's no particular class.
Well, is it treating them differently when you tie it into the disparate impact on women and minorities who earn less and therefore have fewer economic damages, therefore a much larger percentage of their award is non-economic?
And
tie that in with what Judge Price was saying about is there a rational basis for that?
Yeah, and again, this, I go back to Adams, on whether or not this is past the scrutiny before. This is past that scrutiny before.
Adams didn't address that issue.
Adams addressed, no, it didn't address its disparate impact on women or
children. I didn't mean
children to
deflect from Judge Price's. Just add that. We were
add
saying
that
it's
it.
Not suspect, but in fact some of them may be in suspect classes, so that was your answer.
Yeah, some
didn't
some of them,
address it.
But it's not directed at them. And
well, disparate impact, I mean, is that principle applicable here? Because the point of disparate impact is you don't look at what people's rationale was, you look at the impact, and the impact is different.
Right, and the rationale,
it's from the employment context. Is it applicable in this kind of context? The cases address that.
I don't believe it is applicable in this context with this level of scrutiny, and that is rational basis scrutiny.
But my point is, if it's affecting a suspect class, then you don't get rational basis. You increase it.
Yeah, potentially.
I'm not saying that applies here enough, but tell me why it doesn't in your view.
I don't believe it applies here because it is not the way it's formulated is not intended to address any of those, and nor am I aware that there's any evidence to support in this case that it is affecting these plaintiffs differently. That they are in that suspect classification and is treating them differently than somebody that would be an adult that would have the same injuries that happened to the plaintiff in this case. So I'm not sure I fully to answer your question there, or...
And I deflected you from Judge Price's, so please go ahead. And
and I don't know if I fully answered your question or not, but let me just finish by saying a couple of things. And that is, there are innumerable provisions in the statutes which adjust, alter, or amend common law causes of action and remedies. Joint and several liability is redirecting some of those damages where they go to. Sovereign immunity puts caps on certain. So there's, opposing counsel indicated there's no parade of horribles. There is. Those things would be dramatically affected. And the logical conclusion would be they would be under siege from the same type of principles. Let me just touch real briefly on the cross-claim or counter cross-appeal, and that is...
Sovereign immunity was recognized in 1820, correct?
Yes.
So that's not really comparable, is it?
No, sovereign immunity was, but again, it's the question of do they have the power to abrogate or limit? And their sovereign immunity existed, and it was a power... to not be liable at all. Sovereign immunity as it exists now is a limiting principle.
Does the Constitution say sovereign immunity shall be preserved inviolate?
Does it say it shall be preserved inviolate? No, it doesn't, Your Honor. There's no other question. We ask that this court affirm the trial court's decision and this court's decision in Adams and reverse on the cross appeal or with regard to the calculation of those medical future damages. Thank you, Your Honors.
So you're not arguing equal protection in, for example, for a stay-at-home mom and you have medical malpractice committed, or let's say a jury finds medical malpractice, then you get the family gets no economic damage. There's no economic damage for a stay-at-home mom, and so you're limited to non-economic damage. You're making no assertions on equal protection?
No, we've made those assertions in the brief, Your Honor. I just ran out of time and didn't get to equal protection, but...
Yeah, I thought one of the clients' dissents was very good on that matter.
Mr. Morgan stated that there's no evidence in this record regarding the disparate impact. Is that a correct statement?
Well, I think you have two analyses. I mean, the first is whether strict scrutiny applies, and we argue that it does because this implicates a constitutional right, and then it's their burden to show a compelling interest in whether the statute's narrowly tailored, and they haven't made that showing.
But do you have to first present some statistics or some evidence to support the claim that it has a greater impact on protected classes?
Well, I don't think we've argued that there's a protected class here. We have a child, and we've shown that it does have a disparate impact on children. And you have the facts of this case, which show that the lion's share of the damages are non-economic, that this was a real harm.
How do we get to a compelling interest from having a greater effect on a child when that's not a suspect class?
We haven't argued compelling interest on that basis, Your Honor.
Okay.
But
go ahead.
Well, I was going to go back, Justice, to your question. You said, I'm concerned about the slippery slope with respect to right to trial by jury if the jury's determination of facts is rendered advisory. And we're telling you that you are already there. You are down that slippery slope because the statute as applied does render the jury's verdict advisory. You asked, where is the line? And Scott and Judge Wolf in his concurrence and Klotz drew a line. What he said was, where the common law action is retained and litigants have access to a jury, then the Constitution commits to the jury the determination of facts. And that's the line you have here. That doesn't mean that the legislature can't abrogate a cause of action or create a cause of action. Look at Scott and the state of Overbay. There the court said that where the legislature defines the substance of the claim, it still cannot enact a procedure that violates the Constitution. Now there, because you had a cause of action created by statute without analog in the common law, it was up to the legislature to define the remedies. But here we have a common law cause of action. The legislature is not acting incident to its power to abrogate the common law. And there was a reference to federal decisions. Those decisions reference Tull versus United States, which is the same case that Adams referenced. And that's not a case about, that's a case about civil penalties, not about civil actions. And this is what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Feltner. There was an argument there, does the jury really need to determine the amount of damages for the substance of the right to be preserved? And this is what the court said. If a party so demands, a jury must determine the actual amount of damages in order to preserve the substance of the common law right of trial by jury. That's what the Georgia Supreme Court has held, and Sophie, and all of these courts. And Judge Wolf has drawn that line. And this is the easy case. I was asked about wrongful death. Those cases pose other problems or other questions that the court has to answer. But here there is no question with respect to the common law cause of action which has been retained. If I can say one more thing about equal protection. For rational basis review, here we have showed, basically based on the Missouri Department of Insurance reports, that there was no rational basis for adopting a far more stricter cap in the 2004-2005 legislative term. All the bases that Cox Medical Center has argued, this was needed because doctors were fleeing, this was needed because medical malpractice rates are skyrocketing, there simply is no empirical support for those claims. And they have enacted a cap that is different from the cap in Adams because it does not adjust for inflation. It is a highly punitive cap, and it applies especially to children like Nathan Watts because the lion's share of their damages are non-economic. I'm not sure I have any time left. Unless there are any questions, we would ask that the court reverse the decision below. Thank you.